Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Here is part two of my discussion with Ben Stone. Make sure you check out part one. It is podcast 278, Creating a Market Demand for Liberty. This is part two, Diminishing the Market Demand for Government. Thanks one more time to Ben for coming on the show, and check out more of his work at badquaker.com. Here we go.
And the men who hold high places must be the ones who start to mold a new reality closer to the heart, closer to the heart. Blacksmith.
So we can just start here in a second.
I'll try not to monopolize the microphone this time.
No, I was saying to Michael Dean called in when I was on Free Talk Live the other night, and I said I really enjoyed listening to you talk, and it was hard to forget. It was hard to remember that I wasn't listening to a podcast. You know, I've only heard maybe less than, I would say, 10 hours of your work total at this point. So, yeah, I was really enjoying it, and people gave me a lot of positive feedback as well.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that being said, we can just start like this. I finished the Beyond Civil Disobedience series, and I wanted to continue to discuss that today. One of the things that you mention is this idea of going underground, and it made me think back to when I was first discovering all this stuff. And that discovery, as we talked about last time, often comes with a lot of anger, you know? And I said, well, and this was many years ago, but I said, well, I'm just going to do everything I can to give the finger to these people. And lately, I've been getting more interested in agorism. I actually just started a series yesterday about exploring agorism from a variety of angles. So I thought we could start there. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the concept of agorism, the utility of agorism, and where you're at with that maybe in your own life.
My daughter Kai is an agorist in very functional ways. She kind of moves around the country. She works Renaissance festivals. Typically, that's, you know, a cash and carry type of work.
Mm-hmm.
She tries to stay in places, campgrounds or motels or whatever, where, you know, there's no record of it in any way. So that kind of leaves the tax man out of the whole equation. So, she's kind of living that life. And I think it's a really effective tool for anybody who can. There's a lot of people, you know, that just they have families or whatever. They just can't do that. They have to have, you know, whatever, an office job or a factory job or whatever. But it's a very effective method for separating yourself from, you know, from the filth of the state, if you can put it that way.
Yeah, it kind of feels like the more I think about it, like I'm a little bug in a web, you know, as you try to start figuring out how to really pull yourself out of it.
Right.
But I'd like to find more ways to do that, more ways to disconnect myself, including as a consumer. You know, the last show that I did was with this gentleman named Jamin. And, you know, he's got a whole sustainable living operation. I was out in the middle part of New Hampshire the other day at my friend's farm, and he's doing aquaponics, and he had pigs coming the next day. And it's just wonderful. I walked away with 36 fresh eggs. So
wow.
It's more things like that, you know, and it's hard because I want people to understand that, yeah, it's not 35 acres and aquaponics and a greenhouse that you need. It can be small steps along the way, little pieces of that web that you can start to break.
Yeah, Jamin is amazing. I know him, and he's a really, really good guy, and I've met his wife and their kids and stuff. But that's just amazing what he's accomplished there on his farm.
Yeah, absolutely. I was stunned when I read his story. I was like, this is unbelievable. Yeah, I didn't ask in the show, but I was trying to gauge how old he was. And I looked at all the things that he had accomplished, and I was like, maybe he's 70, but I don't think he's much older than me. So
yeah, and yeah, compared to me, he's a young guy with a young family, and you know, a lot of work, a lot of burden of having a young family. But he's pulling it off. He's doing great.
Yeah, and that was another thing we talked about. It's very much about combining work and play. And, you know, there's different kinds of work, and the work that he's doing and other agorists are doing, I think, is just incredibly satisfying. So I'm looking for more people like that that I can spotlight on my show, because I just think it's, you know, a phenomenal way to achieve autonomy in a lot of ways without really making yourself a target.
Yeah. One other thing that we haven't mentioned so far is there's been quite a few people who have left the U.S. and gone to other locations, be that like Southeast Asia. Thailand is a popular escape place, although from what I understand, you don't want to be near the cities because government is big there.
Yep.
But there are several locations in Central and South America that liberty-minded people have moved towards in order to have more of an agorist lifestyle. And that, you know, that's one option. But another is like what Jamin has done, is just sort of disappear into the woodwork right here. And I know another guy, his name escapes me, but he did pretty much the same thing in Canada. Except he didn't even he moved out on so-called public land and didn't ask permission, didn't fill out any papers, just sort of, you know, Canada is so big that he just sort of moved off into the woods and, you know, catch me if you can kind of a thing. And if they find him there, he'll move someplace else.
Yeah. And that's basically homesteading, right? I mean, if it's government land and it's unused. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, well, the idea that you brought up about agorism is this is not an act of protest. I mean, it can be combined, I guess, with other things, but it's more ignoring the government than protesting it and just living life, which I think also can help to, if people are successful, reduce stress, reduce frustration, get out of that Facebook negativity matrix, you know, of just always feeling like I'm an activist, I'm a liberty activist, I have to have my fingers on the pulse of politics. That gets old really fast, for me anyway.
Yeah, it wears you down. Yeah. It's hard to see the progress that we're making if you're, you know, right in the depths of the battle all the time and you're seeing the horrors of government. Horrors, I should pronounce that.
Yeah.
But you're seeing it all the time, and it's really, it can just tax your mind. And if you can get away from that and free your mind of it, and not everybody can do this. You know, there's not one answer. That's really the most important thing to remember. It's really easy to get focused on one solution or one path and, you know, think that if people are not, you know, I really like what the guys in Keene are doing. I shouldn't say guys. The folks in Keene are doing with putting money into parking meters, the Robin Hood of Keene people.
Sure.
I really, really, really like that. I think that's so cool. But that's not for everybody. That's not the whole solution. That's one thing that some people can do. And if they're drawn towards it, man, do that with everything you've got. But agorism is another, more serious activism that maybe could get a person jailed. You know, if that's your, I hate to use the word calling, because they accuse us of being a cult already. So I hate to sound more cultish than we need to be. But if you've got a driving in your heart to do something really radical and it's within the zero aggression principle and you know it's going to help the cause, then, you know, then go for it. But if you can, if agorism is a method that, you know, that you can do, then go for that too, because that's, you know, that's as legitimate as any other.
Yeah, it brings up the question of specialization within liberty activism as well. And I guess, you know, we could say that agorism is not necessarily activism, but when done in mass, it could have a huge impact that people who might be doing more in-your-face civil disobedience or political activism, they'd be really happy with the outcomes of enough people doing agorism, right? Because that puts a huge dent in the state's power.
Yeah, I've been talking in the last year, I've been talking to some of the folks in Michigan in reference to what's going on in, what's that big city in Michigan that's falling apart?
Well, I think we have our pick, but Detroit comes to mind.
Yeah, Detroit. My brain just blanked out for a minute. But I've been talking to different ones that are working in the Detroit area, and agorism is really springing up all over Detroit, and it's not doing so as an aspect of the liberty movement. It's doing so as an aspect of, as the government fails and people still need to live, agorism seems to be a natural thing that they're moving towards. So some of them are what we might consider more leftist or more socialist in their ideas, and some are not. And, you know, there's every blend and combination. They're not all politically towards the libertarian side. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm not sure it really matters so long as in the long run, what we accomplish is living without the burden of the government giving us permission or denying us permission or taxing us every time we turn around. However we can get out of that successfully, even if it's not specifically for, you know, liberty purposes, it still ends up being for liberty purposes. We still end up being free.
Absolutely. And, you know, the reason I bring up the word specialization is, you know, when we talk about certain things, my listeners, I think it's a pretty diverse group, and I don't want to frustrate anybody, you know, like talking about how great it is to be an agorist or permaculture. And I think there's probably people who listen and they would say, well, that's nice, Brett. That's a nice story. I have, you know, two kids and I'm an accountant, and that's kind of like how my life works right now. But there's a lot of diversity in what people can do. And I think it's also important for me to realize that, because I see a lot of people doing things that I wouldn't do. In Keene, for example, where I live, you know, and mm-hmm. I see an activity and I say, gosh, I wouldn't do that. We talked about Kokesh and Keene last time, and I've seen Kokesh do things that I wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. I don't even understand why he does them, you know, operating from my hierarchy of values and needs. It doesn't make sense to me to do something like that. But to recognize that there's that diversity, and that having some specialization based on interests or goals or skills is very useful. And I think it's helped me be more understanding instead of just I felt for a while like I was a real naysayer, like, oh, that won't work, or that's a silly thing to do. And I'm trying to see that, you know, everybody is working towards a common goal, and to understand the different things that people do. But also on that understanding, I hope it's possible that we can have discussions about strategies. Like, hey, I get what you're trying to do, but I don't think that will work because. I think that's important as well.
I think so. If I can put it in an oppositional way, our enemy is very organized, you know, government and people who believe in government and support it. And they're very organized, and they have, you know, a whole system from not long after the cradle to the grave, where there's a constant indoctrination process. They're constantly reinforcing what they indoctrinate. You know, all the way from early school, all the way through dependency and retirement. And so they have this whole thing. It's taken them 13,000 years to structure this thing in such a way. And we essentially have been doing this for roughly 200 years, 250 years, but really in the last 100 years, it's starting to get refined. And it's only in the last 20 years that we have gotten this thing of ours to the point of where it's starting to really make sense, and we can start to see a future without the burden of the state, and we can answer the questions: what about the roads? What about retirement? What about, you know, who's going to provide police protection? Who's going to protect us from the tribe over the hill or whatever? We're just now in the last 20 years starting to be able to logically go through all those different things. And we're going up against a 13,000-year-old well-organized enemy. And so it's wise for us to learn from each other and kick ideas around a little bit among ourselves before we go and, you know, get thrown in jail for 20 years or something.
Yeah, I think there's a good point there that, you know, the state very much is fighting a war on all fronts and has been for a long time. And, you know, I think we can identify the really revolutionary or transformative forces throughout history. I would say one has certainly been art, and the government eventually people figured out, hey, well, okay, we'll subsidize it. I mean, that's going on now. It was going on during the Renaissance. Another one is science. They said, okay, we'll subsidize it. The other one is education. And obviously subsidy gives an incredible amount of control. That goes without saying. And the other one is education as a revolutionary and transformative force. And you know, governments came up with school and eventually tricked people into considering that to be education. Yeah. So, and that's, you know, just the big picture. There's infiltration into all of these various industries, including entertainment. So, yeah, their bases are covered, or its bases are covered, and it is very well organized. But, you know, another thing that you bring up in the Beyond Civil Disobedience series is that we shouldn't see government as the enemy, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, government. I like to look at it like this, and my regular listeners have probably heard this so much that they're rolling their eyes as I say this, and they're saying, Ben's going to do his government state thing again. But I look at it, and this is because of lack of terminology in the English language. I distinguish two different things between government and state. Mm-hmm. Government being all these people who, you know, they wear uniforms or they drive official vehicles or they have some kind of title, or one way or the other, they work for or they support in some way government. And I look at that as government. And that includes things like, you know, their holy statues in Washington, D.C. with their, you know, their obelisks and their Mount Rushmore with the holy heads on there that we bow to. Mm-hmm. All of that I see as government. And I see that as a religion, and then I see the state as sort of the god of that religion. The state is that concept in the mind that makes a person think that all these things are legitimate. It's the actual mythology, and it's the god that all these other things represent. Well, so when we think of these people in government, we shouldn't think of them as our enemies. We should think of that religion as our enemy, that God, that state, that's our enemy. These people who are working in government are simply deceived. They're uneducated. In essence, even the worst of them, they very often think, we think of the worst ones in government, you know, the Harry Reids, the John McCains. We think of them as really monsters. Mm-hmm. But very often they deeply believe that they're doing good, that they're helping humanity in what they do. And it's because they're deceived in their religion. And so having feeling of them as an enemy, as a direct enemy, I think is a mistake. I think we need to look at them as being deceived, possibly sick, and not necessarily, you know, it's not our job to heal them as much as it is our job to work around them in any way that we can.
Right. So kind of more like fantasy fighters. And we want to, because the government is people, we want to deal with people always as individuals. Because I think we know how it feels to not be dealt with as an individual, right?
Right.
And those feelings, I think, translate to them as well. Like, that's frustrating. And unfortunately, it might even be reinforcing this us versus them mentality. And I mean, I know that firsthand from having been a teacher, even though I wasn't a government employee. It was a domination system that pitted people against each other, you know, for the survival of the system. And we felt like even though we were there to serve kids, which is what I think a lot of people think they're doing in government, the people you are supposed to be serving become your enemy because of that system.
Yeah, think of it in the case of let's say soldiers in war. Mm-hmm. If soldiers in a war began thinking of the soldiers on the other side as individual human beings with lives and with families and with mothers and with brothers and sisters and with children, it becomes very difficult to kill that person because all of a sudden they become an individual, not just, you know, the other side, the opponent, the army. And that's the same way even with a cop. You know, as long as the cop maintains this mentality of, you know, I'm the policeman, you're civilians, I'm here to, you know, the authority to tell you how to live your life and be safe, and I'm here to make sure you drive the right speed limit, and I'm here to make sure you obey all the laws. And as long as he's thinking that way, he's not thinking of you as a human. He's thinking of you as a thing that he can control and manipulate and dominate, and if need be, hit, stun, continue beating, shoot. Mm-hmm. You know, because he's not thinking of you as a guy with a wife and a kid and a mom and a dad and a brother and a sister. He doesn't think of you that way. He thinks of you as one part of a large object.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we can't reciprocate that. We have to realize that when we're dealing with government, the best way to do it and the best way to kill that God that I was talking about, the state, is to individualize it and to talk to individuals and be an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the series, you actually, when we talk about addressing this myth and deconstructing this myth or this God, you have four things that you say we need to be doing. And I wanted to go through those and talk about each one if we could. The most important, the first one, I don't know if you would consider it the most important, is making the moral argument.
Yeah, because above and beyond all else, that's the ground that we own. That's the looking at it back from a war point of view. Sun Tzu, a really long time ago, was an educator for the Emperor of China in teaching the emperor the art of war. Mm-hmm. And so he gave advice as to what the smartest way to engage in war is. And one of the things that he emphasized is to pick your battleground, pick where you want to fight, don't let your enemy pick where the fight is taking place. Well, our strongest ground that we can stand on is our morality. We by holding the position of zero aggression or of non-aggression, we hold the moral high ground. And so we should choose to fight using primarily that moral high ground. The enemy being, again, this myth of the state, their primary weapon, the primary weapon of people in government, is violence and the threat of violence. So if we're sidestepping that to begin with, we've already got the moral high ground, and we've already won that part of the battle.
Okay, so here's the trick with that I've realized over the years, and I'm interested in your thoughts. I remember when I first heard I don't know, was it episode one of Free Domain Radio? That might have been how the clearest articulation of this I might have heard. I said, oh, great, I win. You know, I've been looking for this. Now I will always be right. When I tried to share this with people, I found it was not only frustrating for them, it was offensive because it contained, if they were supporting, you know, or they're part of the state, they're supporting the government, they believe in all of this. It's kind of an indictment against them, right? It's kind of asking them to do a 180 on the morality that we're taught most of our lives, which is very much a self-sacrificial kind of ethics and you know, the collective over the individual. So this is a, you know, it's not just, I think, what our activity is or what our goal is. It's also the behavior and strategies along the way. And I have to admit that I made a lot of moral arguments in the past with bad strategies. So who do you picture addressing or you know, discussing these moral arguments with? And what experiences have you had with that?
Well, a lot of times, you know, a lot of times the best evangelism, if I can put it that way, is living what you're saying more than saying what you're saying.
Indeed.
So a lot of times it's not so much in going out and, you know, expressing these ideas to people as much as it is setting an example, and then until the point of where they seek the answer, they seek what it is that's different about us. This is the case, you know, I think I going back to a religious point of view. You know, there's so many religions that, or so many denominations of Christianity that really focus on sending essentially recruiters or evangelists or whatever out to just bug people to death until they, you know, until they are convinced of your religious ideas. And that probably works with a percentage of people. But a large percentage of people get annoyed by that. A lot of people don't want you coming to their door and bothering them, or, you know, constantly at work telling them, you know, the opinions, religious opinions or whatever. They don't want to hear it. Mm-hmm. And it annoys them more than it converts them. And I think a lot of times people tending towards the liberty argument, we kind of get like that. And I think that's why we get accused sometimes of being a cult or cult-like, is because we kind of act like it in that sense. We're constantly evangelizing, where maybe we should just be more, you know, doing it and setting the example. And like you were talking about agorism, just doing it, and less trying to convince people that it's the correct way. Just if you live it, more work and less talk maybe would be a bumper sticker way of putting it.
Yeah, and another thing that comes up and that I've realized is a lot of people aren't prepared for that. And because of that, this kind of evangelizing, it just seems often to others like belligerence or even bullying, you know, like trying to bully people morally or intellectually into agreeing with you. And that certainly, because it's hard to think about what can I gather up and show people that suggests I live this moral argument. And it's, you know, you can't have like a portfolio always to present them. Like, here are the things that I do. But a lot of it, I think, or their perception can come from that interaction. Your behavior, your understanding, your empathy, your acceptance of what they feel, what they're going through, what it's like for them to be confronted with all of this. Because I think it's important to put those ideas out there, but it all comes down to strategy. And that actually leads probably into a discussion about part two with the practical arguments. So these were again, just to review for people, these were the four things you said in that series that we ought to be doing. The first one was making these moral arguments. The second one was about practical arguments, which I'm guessing is addressing the failure of things like collectivism and forced associations. Now, I've heard people warn against this, but I think considering where most people are, the practical arguments might be easier to grab and easier to accept in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I believe so very much. And people tend to fall back. They will very often, as you're talking to them, they'll say the old thing about the roads. They'll say, well, that all sounds great, except the real world that we live in, we need somebody to build the roads. Mm-hmm. Or in the real, you live in a fantasy world, but in the real world, we need to call the cops when somebody's, you know, doing X, Y, Z or whatever. And so now we go into the practical world, and when we say, well, but there are solutions, there are better ways of doing this. And then if you have the facts, then you can carefully and humbly explain that there have always been societies that maintained order without having a violent thug to force order upon everyone. And there are all kinds of examples in history of this. And there are examples in our day-to-day lives. You know, families, a properly functioning family does not stay together because the dad's going to beat everybody if they don't behave. Mm-hmm. That's not how a properly functioning family works. I talk about my family and the family reunions we have in Appalachia. I talk about that quite a bit. For a very, very long time, lots of years, my family has voluntarily come together at one of the members' homes that's deep in the mountains of Appalachia, and we're far away from, you know, an ambulance service or a sheriff's office, or it's pretty far away from any real city of any size, and there's no hardwired structure as to how this takes place. We've all pretty much decided the best weekend for it to happen. So that's the weekend it ends up happening every year. There's no set. You don't have to show up with chicken in order to be allowed in. But if you don't show up with anything, you're still allowed in. And yeah, yet there's always more food than we can eat. There are very religiously fanatical people that I'm related to that come to this family reunion. And there are those who are non-religious at all, and there are those somewhere in the middle. And yet, and it's not a problem. There's no fights. We just get together and we focus on the things that we have in common. And there are, you know, I would say probably 60 to 70% of the people at any one of these family reunions are armed. And there's never been a single fight in all the years that I've gone to one or known about it going on. We've never had an incident where anyone got into a fight of any kind. And if they did, we wouldn't call the cops because it's going to be 30, 40 minutes before they get there anyway. Mm-hmm. So that would be an illogical thing to do. So if there was some kind of a conflict, we would settle it among ourselves. So this is an example of how people can come together voluntarily and not have to have a hierarchy or a hardwired authority with threats of violence over top of them. So we can use, going back to the four things, we can use our practical life and we can use morality in our day-to-day life. And then there's also the practical working out of this that, yes, it does work. In fact, you know, voluntary systems work all the time. It's how the Red Cross became what it is today. It's how, you know, different charity organizations became the size and the scope that they are.
Yeah, absolutely. It's how our relationships work. It's in a lot of ways, you know, it's not the professional world or the work world is not perfect. Because I think there's there's a difference in people forcing you to do things and circumstances forcing you to do things, but both suck. One is certainly worse than the other, but there is a considerable lack of freedom, obviously, in the work world. But the point still stands that we see voluntary interactions happening all around us all the time, and that should be, yes, a good example of the practical argument.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The third one on the list was, you can expand on this, earning money for yourself and your family.
Yeah, on the priorities that a person needs to realize for themselves is first and foremost maintaining your own morality. Second, the practical aspects of what we're doing. And third is we have certain – even though, you know, the individualist thinking and the ideas that a lot of libertarians have that we don't really owe anything to anybody, each one of us is individual. And yet – if we have a response, if we have a relationship with someone, whether that's a husband, a wife, or a significant person in your life, or whatever, you do have a certain amount of responsibility to maintain that relationship as much as they have the responsibility back with you. And if you have children in that, then you also have that responsibility. And in dealing with all these things, you pretty much have to make money some way. You know, it doesn't have to be government money. You know, we can, there's, like we were talking about with agorism, there's all kinds of ways that you can, equivalent of government money, you know, doing things different through barter or through other means, mm-hmm. Cryptocurrencies or whatever. But one way or the other, you know, you have to do something to feed yourself and to feed the ones that are too young or weak to feed themselves. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's not pleasant. Sometimes you have to go in and you have to punch a clock and you have to walk into the government facility and smile and do, you know, whatever it is that you have to do during, you know, especially when you're younger and you don't have a choice because of the system that we're stuck with. You just have to make some money. You have to make a living.
Yeah. Yeah. This has become kind of a tricky one for me. And there's a couple of things here. One has more to do with PR, right? So one of the things that's happened in New Hampshire, and it's understandable, and, you know, so I don't want to be too hard on anybody, but it is an observation that I've made kind of, you know, with a foot in each camp, like a foot in the activist camp, but also feeling somewhat attached to, just through my own family, which is mostly pretty mainstream thinkers, people that I care about, people that I spend time with. But, you know, I can see both points of view. And, you know, I think that if somebody rolls into town and crashes on a couch and they have nothing, but they're just so determined to, you know, push the moral and practical arguments for liberty, it's a difficult sell. If the audience is ordinary folks in the town and they see somebody with a sign or a megaphone, and they look the person up and down, as so many people often do. Like, I think appearance counts for a lot. I know you've addressed this in these shows that we're talking about. And somebody who might be willing to listen observes this activist, and they say, I don't think that person even owns an iron. You know, I don't think that person has been to the laundromat in a month. That counts for something. Presentation can either enhance or take away from somebody's message. And the reason why I say that is I'm often wondering where the priority of financial stability and security should be in activism. I know that you talked about, you know, you had some health issues recently, and so did I. And I was kind of going through the process of dealing with that, and it made me reflect a lot on some of the financial choices that I've made in the past when you see how quickly expenses can add up. And, you know, I remember thinking, like, you know, I had a pretty secure life until maybe 2009. And looking back, I think I became so enthusiastic and so quickly reassured by the success of what I was doing as far as, like, the reception, I kind of forgot about money, you know, and savings slowly dwindled down to very little. And I started realizing that, you know, I wasn't on the steadiest and stablest of ground. And it made me ask, am I doing the best activism I can? You know, so I only say that because a lot of young people listen to this show, and I would hate for them to kind of have that same thing happen to me, which I think was the result of poor planning, to say, I'm so excited about these ideas. Nothing else matters as much. I'm going to make the moral and practical arguments. And, you know, that for, you know, financial stability and success, I trade that off to do this good work.
Yeah. And without going into a long, you know, another hour of me telling my history. But,
sure, sure.
But I kind of have the opposite history of that. I came into it very enthusiastic, and but then realized I have to make a living. I have a brand new wife and we're having a new family. And so I just had to lower my head, close my mouth, and, you know, keep mining salt until I was in a position where I could pick my head back up. My children are adults. They're off on their own. They're not my responsibility anymore. My wife and I have, you know, enough that we can get rid of some bills. We can have, like, in our RV, we don't owe anything on our RV. So we don't have the threat of anybody coming and, you know, saying, well, you missed a payment, so we're just taking your home away. You know, we don't have that threat. But we worked many, many years before we got to that point. And so now I have the luxury that I can sit back and talk to people about it and spread the message in the way that I'm doing. But the reason I'm able to do that is because behind me is, you know what, the 35 years of work to get to where I'm at, 35 years of keeping my head down, well, about 30 years of keeping my head down, not saying my opinion, earning money, and just taking the lash, you know. And I'm not saying that's for everybody. I'm not saying that at all. Some people... that's not the thing for them, but for some of us, we just take the lash, keep your head down, keep rowing until the point comes that you can snap those chains and dive out the window.
Yeah, that's a really good insight, and I'm wondering if that's harder to do for some people today. Now, we're all different, right? And like, I had really, when I started doing this, I had no responsibility. I had a girlfriend at the time, but I didn't have any kids. I didn't own a home. I had a life that allowed for that. And obviously my priorities could be much different. I was also in a different field. I was in education, you know, and I felt like I just kept learning my way out of what I was doing. Like, the more I learned, it would just be like, oh, I can't do this anymore. The truth is, I didn't want to do it anymore. And I found a reason why I could get out. I could sell getting out of it right then and there without thinking through all the consequences. Maybe I could sell that to myself. I could say, this is immoral. I'm, you know, participating in a problem, so I'm going to leave it at, like, next week. So yeah, I mean, I think that was the result of maybe being a little too impulsive and poor planning. But another thing that I worry about, and this is just from my experience, and I would guess the same is true for others. You were having this period of discovery, you know, late 70s, early 80s, right?
Right, yeah.
Right. And I think today, for many young people, it's so much more intense because you sit down in front of what every day? A computer. And it's like, look what George Bush did now. Look what Obama said yesterday. Look what the TSA is doing. Look. And I think there was an awareness of all of that 35 years ago. But the intensity and how it affects people today, I think might be more significant. So more people are maybe chomping at the bit to get out there and do something about it. And they also might be more enthusiastic about stepping away from the system as they see it, even if it means less money and less security and maybe, you know, less medical insurance. So it might be more challenging today.
Yeah, things are, you know, I hate to sound like every other old person in the world, but things are moving so much faster now, and they're getting faster every moment. Yeah, we all know that computers are getting faster and faster and faster. But, you know, if there was some way to make the argument in physics that time itself is speeding up, it almost seems that way. Everything is going faster. Tyranny is growing faster. Liberty is growing faster. You know, ideas are exchanged at rates that no one could have imagined 10 years ago. And so, you know, it's difficult to sit down for 30 years and do nothing, because for one reason you think, holy crap, if I sit down and do nothing for 30 years and then try to come into this, what's it going to be like then?
Yes.
It's a scary thought.
Yeah, absolutely. So that whole discussion, I think, came out of my question of what are the priorities? And I just wanted to address, when should people start doing this? And I think your story provides at least one answer. My story provides maybe some information about, like, don't do it exactly this way. But I think we can move on to the fourth one, which is assisting government in its path to self-destruction.
Yeah, and the least important, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Because here's the thing. I truly believe that this, going back to this religion that I was talking about earlier, this state religion, I believe it is seriously flawed, and at some point in time it's going to collapse. And I believe that for economic reasons and also for moral reasons. And if I didn't believe that, if that weren't a primary aspect of my beliefs, that this thing is going to collapse, then I would re-examine my own beliefs and say, well, then if it's not going to collapse, then maybe it's not so bad. Maybe it's just how we have – it's the rules of the universe and we have to flow with it. But the fact is, dominance like that is contrary to human nature. It's contrary to human nature to allow dominance like that. And so government itself and this God, the state – is actually against human nature, and I believe that to be the case. Therefore, either humans will ultimately reject it or it will destroy humanity. And mm-hmm. I don't want to believe that humanity is absolutely doomed. But even if humanity is doomed, and even if the state will ultimately crush humanity, then the state dies with it, because the moment the last human who believes in the state dies, the state dies as well. Their God evaporates when that takes place.
Right.
So all we have to do is outlive the statists, you know, we collectively as people who reject this religion. So because of all that, I believe that at some point in time, this religion of the state will die, and the God of the state will vanish with it. And when that happens, we win. Now, so that might happen a week from now, or 10 years from now, or 100 years from now, or 10,000 years from now. Not, you know, we don't have any control over that. On the other hand, so it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I believe the state is going to collapse. The God of the state is eventually going to join the ranks of Zeus and, you know, Thor and Odin, and he's going to be something that people tell tales about and draw cartoons about, but he doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, what can we do to make that happen a little quicker? Well, the one thing we don't want to do is do anything that helps it, like have a revolution, because history teaches us that when you have a revolution, you fool the people into thinking something's going to change, but then the new government comes right back in like the old, and it's just as bad as it was. So revolution's not the answer.
Right.
So then what is the answer? And I talk about, I make it in a cute way. Like, we don't want to, you know, directly assault the state. What we want to do is just put some Legos out in the carpet. So when he wakes up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, he steps on those. And
so, yeah. So, and I'm interested, what are maybe you're going to get into this, but I'd love to hear some examples of that, some practical examples.
Some of them are way on the radical side. Okay, so we consider, and I'm going to go for the most radical first, and okay. then we can come back to calm.
You know, all right.
But let's go. You were expressing some feelings earlier that I think pretty much everybody goes through at some point in their journey towards understanding liberty, and that is this frustration of wanting to do something. When you really see how hideous this beast is, you want to run up and stab it. You want to do something to kill it. When you see what a monster this religion is, you know, it brings out anger in you. I was listening to Adam Kokesh's show the other day with Bill Buford on there, and they were talking about cops killing cats. Mm-hmm. And it just makes you want to just run out and kick a cop, you know. But of course, that's counterproductive. That's not going to be that's not a wise thing to do, and it won't help anything in the long run.
Sure.
So let's you have that frustration. You feel like you have to do something. Well, do something that's going to A, follow the non-aggression principle, and B, be productive towards actually ending the state. And so rather than kick the cop in the shin, let's look at this very cold and very careful and find out what is within the zero aggression principle. So a story that I tell sometimes is that when I was young, I got really upset with the cops in the town that I lived in. And so I took wire cutters and I went to the police cars late, like 3 o'clock in the morning or something. And I clipped off all the antennas off all the police cars in right. my town. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's really dangerous to do that. Now, the question is it violating the non-aggression principle or the zero aggression principle? And the answer is no, it is not violating. Now, if I clip the antennas off of Brett's car, you know, then right. that's violating the non-aggression principle because I am attacking Brett's personal property. Mm-hmm. But a police car belongs to the government, and the government is an imaginary entity that can't own any property. So the government owns no property. So all property that the government claims to own is actually stolen property that no longer belongs to anybody and is available for homesteading. So when I clipped the antennas off the police cars, the risk I was taking was significant, and the value that it committed was very low. It didn't, you know, they just pay and put more antennas on. Mm-hmm. But it was not breaking the zero aggression principle because I was not aggressing on any person's property. That was homesteadable property, and for the moment that I was clipping those antennas, I owned them. Mm-hmm. Now, if you can think of a way to clip antennas in some other way, like if you could do something to slow down the wheels of government and cause it to let's take it in a more practical way. Let's say your job, you work for the Internal Revenue Service and mm-hmm. you process tax forms. That's what you do for a living. Well, okay, you're stuck doing that. It's not what you want to do. You realize it's helping the state, but just start doing your job way slower. Intentionally lose files. Intentionally gum up the process. If if you're a night guard at a government facility, you can just slowly do everything that you're doing, but do it far worse and with less gusto. And just do your part to make the wheels turn as slow as possible. You're ripping off the government, so in a sense, but in another way, you're not. You're just helping this beast die a little quicker than it would have otherwise. And again, that's the most radical ways.
Yeah.
But there are more direct confrontations as well. I talked at one point about if you had the means to knock over the Washington Monument, then that would be perfectly within the realm of the zero aggression principle. It may not be practical. It may actually offend people and do more harm than good, but it would be within the realm of the zero aggression principle.
And we want to be clear that we're not planning that. We're not recommending that. Just for the record, I want no part of that. It is a hypothetical example, and it raises the question, right? All the things you talked about first were covert activities, because then I think this question, in fighting the myth and not the institution or individuals themselves, perception matters, public relations matters. So you wouldn't want to do these things and then say, ha ha ha, look how crappy I am at my job, because the perception would be, well, you know, you have an employment contract and you're violating it. This has actually been a really hot topic on my show lately. I've been doing a series with a historian named Thaddeus Russell, and he was kind of singing the praises of a group of activists who smoke pot at Liberty Forum in a hotel. And he said, well, you know, that corporation is totally the beneficiary of government force, so I don't have a problem with it. And I was like, yeah, but it's even if you're right, even if that argument does win some way, it's still a public relations issue. So all those things that you talked about first, you're talking about being covert activities that are specifically for the purpose of assisting government in a path it's already on.
Yeah. And what you're talking about there, public relations, is really, really important. And let me bring up Ron Paul for a second. One of the reasons that Ron Paul was so successful, and so many people credit Ron Paul with breaking them into the liberty, the way of liberty thinking and so forth, is that Ron Paul was so clean. And he tried so hard within the system to do things right, and he didn't take bribes, and he didn't do all the nasty things that we think of government doing. So, so he was a perfect PR person for our movement. On the other hand, there's other ways of doing this as well. And one of the things that I talked about in the series is, for instance, let's say you are a really good hacker. And you had the capability of hacking into government computer systems. Well, maybe instead of doing something like stealing credit card numbers or stealing identities, what if you could get in and create fake identities? What if you could get in to government computers and, say, create 100,000 fake Social Security recipients and then – have all that Social Security money mailed to specific accounts, and then you refunneled that back into liberty projects of one kind or another. Well, you're sucking out of the giant government a pool, we'll say.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And of course, this is all stolen money anyway. But you're getting it back into a more functional thing that's going to use it into society. In a better way than government's going to use it, because how is government? There's this way of thinking that's real common on the right side of the political scale, where it's kind of like they imagine government money as having individual accounts, where there's an account for the roads and there's an account for fishing and wildlife, and there's an account for retirement and for Social Security, and there's an account for military, and somehow the government puts all this money into these separate accounts. And so if you go in and you take a bunch of that money out of one of those accounts, then people are going to starve, old people are going to starve. But in fact, government doesn't work that way. They steal as much as they can steal all the time. Whatever the maximum amount that they can steal and not have a revolution, that's how much they steal. And what they can't get away with stealing openly through taxation, they'll steal through fractional reserve, monetary expansions, and through inflation. So they're always going to steal as much as they can steal, and they're only going to spend the amount that it takes to keep them in power. So if they could get away with not building roads and not paying old people, to retire, and if they could get away with not paying those things, they wouldn't pay them. They only do that to keep people pacified. So
I totally agree. Yeah.
So as you're, if you could create 1,000 identities all receiving the maximum Social Security amount, and you could funnel that all into another program that then goes around and does something else for the liberty cause, then in essence, you would, first off, you'd be taking a huge risk that could get you in jail for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. But you could also be, while you're doing that, you're spreading Legos on the carpet in the middle of the night. That's kind of one activist way of doing that, that you could argue that you're not even really aggressing on anyone because you're not really stealing owned property anyway.
Right. And I think you addressed one of the concerns that was starting to form for me while you were talking about it, which is what if you creating 1 million fake identities gums up the work? It's the works at Social Security, and, you know, 1,000 people, let's say, arbitrarily don't get their payments for 3 months. Yeah, obviously, that's a huge problem. And that's another issue with government is the amount of dependence that it creates in people. So it just seemed like a place to inject the need for knowledge and strategy. People are going to try to do these things. But I think you address that, that there wouldn't be a problem if it didn't affect individuals who, unfortunately, based on the lives they've led and what they've been taught, are depending on a program like Social Security. And, you know, I think that's another thing about the hearts and minds argument and dealing with individuals and getting them on your side. This thing is coming down. You know, look at how many people are right now standing in its shadow. And how can we get more of them out? And unfortunately, you know, it's really tragic, but they're not all going to leave the shadow.
Right.
So, yeah, I think you addressed the concern I was having that, wow, this could wind up, you know, hurting individuals.
I think of that. There's a line in the first Matrix movie, I believe it was, where the guy says, you know, there are people that are in the Matrix that are so damaged that we can't help them. They're not going to make it outside of the Matrix. And unfortunately, that is exactly the case with government. Government has so many people that are so damaged that when it fails, whether we are involved in its failure or not, it's going to fail one way or the other. But when it fails, there are legions of people who are so dependent upon this thing that they're going to suffer horribly. And
yeah,
whether we, you know, push the government to die quicker, therefore take, you know, ultimately in the long run, less people will be affected. Let's go back in time. Let's say if it was the year 1900 and we had Murray Rothbard talks about a magic button. If you had this magic button that you could push and stop government, Murray said that he would blister his thumb pushing that button. Well, mm-hmm. I have an argument against Murray's argument, but yeah. Let's just say for the sake of you know, for a little mental exercise, if we could go back in time to 1900 and push Murray's button and stop government then and there, think of how many people would not have suffered during the 20th century and died at the hands of government. And think about how many people in 2014 would not be addicted to the government and dependent upon the government. If we could have pushed that button in 1900, you know, certainly that would have been merciful. Even if there would have been suffering then, the proportion would have been much lower than it is today. Multiply that out another 100 years or another generation or another 5,000 years. What dependence will the population have then, and how bad will they suffer then? You know, so
that's a really good point, actually. Yeah, it's a difficult thing to think about for sure. And when you talk about it in 1900, you know, I was kind of combing through my mental archives there, thinking like, what would be the cost for people who would suffer? And certainly, you know, maybe there could be some arguments made that the federal government was still intervening on behalf of, you know, former slaves or the descendants of former slaves and, you know, the Jim Crow South. But you're right. It's what has happened in the last 115 years as far as the growth of the power of government, and I would even say the belief that mythology, that statism, has expanded at an alarming rate throughout the 20th century, and that was certainly by design. that happened through schooling and academia and the intellectuals and the media and entertainment. Yeah, wow, that's I'm speechless. Even. It's quite an interesting thought.
Yeah, my counter argument to Murray Rothbard's, blister your thumb pushing the button to kill government, my counter argument to that is that anytime there's a market for something, I would scold Murray by going to economics. Anytime there's a market for something, prohibiting that thing will not stop it. So if there's a market for government, and there is today, there are many, many people who desire government. And so long as there's a market for government, there's going to be government. And pushing a button or prohibiting government or forcing liberty upon people, one prominent person recently that I heard mentioned that people just aren't bright enough to accept liberty voluntarily, and it's going to have to be forced on them. Well, any time that you force a prohibition on people, they'll just go around it and have it anyway. So it's silly for us as liberty-minded people and people with maybe a better grasp of economics than most to think that we can make the decision and push the button and kill government. There has to come a time when the market itself prefers liberty over slavery. And as that happens, mind after mind after mind, there becomes more and more of us demanding liberty. Then the market will provide for us that level of freedom that we demand, because that's what the market does. The market is almost like the state in a very serious way, except that it's real. The state is this myth based on force and aggression and theft and horrible things like that. But the market is the real thing. It's the actual thing that we can interact with. And it does provide for us all the blessings that we imagine that government would do, except the market does it for real. So if there's a market demand for freedom, then no government can stop it. And if there's a market demand for government, then no amount of liberty people forcing any issue can stop it. We have to think of it, of government, not as something that we can prohibit, but something that we can provide a better product and just overcompeted in the marketplace.
Let's leave it there. That was great. Philosophers.